Last week, we moved along in 1 Corinthians, and we looked predominantly at chapter 5 and the first part of chapter 7. Basically, what we dealt with was that little three-letter word and its implications not only for the church at the time, but its implications for us even today. Can someone tell me what that little three-letter word with which we dealt was? Sin. Well, yeah, that is a three-letter word that we were dealing with, only we were dealing with it more specifically through what?
Sex.
So I guess that three-letter word can be associated with the other three-letter word, sin, or not. And we were dealing in particular in chapter 5. Paul deals with that situation where there is presumably a leader within the church who is in an illicit relationship, most likely with his stepmother. And how even, Paul says, even the pagans frown upon that, but the church was extremely nonchalant and almost arrogant in some ways, the way that that it handled that situation. We then moved from that point, and we talked about, though, how in that particular situation, that there was a belief by some in the church that membership, and I know people today don't have that belief whatsoever, but that simple membership in the church meant protection from sin and from the devil and from everything else, and it meant you were going to make it to heaven anyway. I mean, there were people back then that would get the name on the roll and then just never show up again. They thought they were covered. But I know that's a foreign concept. And if I could speak clearly with my tongue in my cheek, I would do so. But you all know that that's what I'm doing, at least figuratively. And so Paul urges them, if they truly believe that, then to gently correct or talk with this person. And if they don't get anywhere, to practice a sense of church discipline and turn him out of the church so that perhaps, Paul says, perhaps then the devil can have his body and his soul will be saved. And while some people believed that would literally happen, that the devil would get hold of him, and who knows, it might. I really think that more to the point, Paul was saying, if that happened, then perhaps that person would come to his senses, repent, and then be able to be redeemed. And we talked about how some churches, still these days, there are some churches that practice that kind of thing, even the point of standing up and pointing fingers and calling out people for what they've done wrong, which may work for some folks if you're a masochist especially, but for most of us it'd have the effect of driving us away, probably. Even though we might need to hear some of that, it would still have that effect. We moved from there to chapter 7. Where Paul says, now you've written me as well, and you've asked me some questions, and I want to answer those. And this begins a long section. In fact, for the most of the rest of the letter, Paul deals with specific questions that have been raised by the people at the church in Corinth. These first questions in chapter 7 have to do with celibacy, being celibate, marriage, and then he will deal with divorce in this particular section as well. And we talked last time briefly about his idea that while marriage and sex within marriage are both normal and right, he thinks that celibacy, no sexual contact whatsoever, is the better option. And, of course, that is shaded, as we said, by Paul's belief that Jesus is going to come back any day. Paul doesn't expect to die before Jesus returns. And if you can remain celibate and dedicate yourself totally to God and working for God and working for the church, that is better than having to split your loyalties. But, for Paul, by way of concession, he says, if you can't do that, it is better for you to be married than to be aflame with passion and to be worried all the time about having a relationship with someone else. Also mentioned, I believe, there are some scholars who think that Paul would have been married earlier, and he has probably been at this point. There are a lot who think that maybe his wife left him, or maybe she exercised divorce when he had his big change and took off traveling all over the world. We don't know. But as a Pharisee, trained as a Pharisee, he would have been married as a young man. Others have speculated perhaps Paul's wife had died, but we really don't know. But at this point, he's talking about celibacy and remaining celibate, and he says that's a gift that he has. In verse 7, I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own special gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. So he sees that idea of celibacy as being a gift in his particular case. He then begins to talk to the unmarried and widows again in verse 8 and 9. Verses 8 and 9, and we briefly ended with this last time. I say that it is well for them to remain single as I do. But if they cannot exercise self-control, then they should marry, for it is better to marry than to be aflame with passion. And the idea there is, once again, that if all you're going to be worried about is passion and whether you're having a relationship with someone or not, you're going to be of no use to the church and spreading the gospel. Whereas if you are married, then at least you can devote your time after you devote your time to your spouse, you can devote your time unimpeded toward working toward the church and sharing the good news, because after all, Jesus is coming any day. And so that's, even that is shaded by Paul's belief, as many early Christians had. And this is fairly early in Paul's ministry, and kind of middle of the road in Paul's ministry, but early in his writing career, that Christians won't die of natural causes before Jesus returns. And so there he deals with that whole idea of celibacy, and it's okay to marry. However, in his opinion, it's better not. Then he begins talking about marriage and how it is supposed to operate. And in verses 10 and 11, et in absentia, in verses 10 and 11, he says, now to the married I give charge, or this charge, not I, but the Lord. So he says, you know, what I'm about to tell you, I'm going to give you this charge, I'm going to give you this teaching. Well, it's not really my teaching, this is the Lord's teaching. So better listen up. And that's his attitude here with this. This is the Lord's teaching. A possible reference to the teachings of Jesus found in Mark chapter 10. To the married I give charge, not I but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does, let her remain single, or else be reconciled to her husband. And all the men sitting there going, And then he says, and that the husband should not divorce his wife, and the wives turn and say, nah. So he's saying it's equal here. And that's something else that that was a major change, quite frankly, within the church and within Christianity, within Judaism, and within most other religions of the day. Who had the only right of divorce? Right, the men, the male. In addition to, in Galatians, Paul saying that there's neither slave nor free, Jew nor Greek, male nor female, we're all one in Christ Jesus. What's good for the goose is good for the gander here as well. Even when it comes to social relationships, there is to be equality. Now, Paul is not encouraging divorce here. Notice he's saying that what the Lord says is that you should not, if at all possible, you should not divorce or separate. And if you do, you should be reconciled. Either stay single or be reconciled. So it says marriage is supposed to be permanent. It's not supposed to be broken. It doesn't come with a 10,000-day warranty. As we said last time, and we've said before, that perhaps we need to sometimes at weddings hang up a sign that says adults only, because we should approach the marriage as an adult, not as somebody who says, well, you know, if it doesn't work, we can always pay $100 to a divorce lawyer and it's over. So he says, here, I'm giving you this charge, but it's not from me. It's what Jesus himself says. You should remain married. The ideal for marriage is one man, one woman together forever. That's what he says. And that is still the ideal there. And quite frankly, in my humble opinion, and I hadn't said it in a long time, so I'm going to say it. And that and a dollar gets you a drink machine.
I still haven't seen that drink machine.
Go to Shem Creek Inn. I'm telling you. The Shem Creek Inn in Mount Pleasant. It's still a dollar for the 12-ounce can. Now, it's a dollar and a quarter for the 20-ounce bottle, but it's a dollar for the 12-ounce can. But anyway, what you know, I think what he is saying here and applies even today. That is still the ideal. One man, one woman for life. And so he says, you know, marriage is to be permanent. It's not to be broken. That's the ideal that God planned. That's the ideal that Jesus put forth. That's the ideal that Paul says Jesus would want in this church at Corinth. However, Paul was also a realist. Paul was also a realist. He looked for the ideal, and he still taught the ideal, but he maintained at least some sense of realism and grounding in the world. He recognized that in Corinth, this metropolitan, cosmopolitan city, as in other places in the world, things were not always the ideal. And so in verses 12 and following, he then addresses another interesting situation which includes the possibilities of divorce. I hope y'all aren't practicing for when you're on the cruise ship. Don't get close to the rail. I heard it sounded like a stumble, so I thought maybe it. And we're talking about marriage and divorce here now. He gives advice to those, quite frankly, who are in mixed marriages here. To the rest, I say, and not the Lord, but I say, and yet this is a situation where Paul expects them to listen to what he has to say, just as if Jesus himself were talking. Et in absentia. To the rest, I say, and big emphasis on the fact that he's doing this, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. So the ideal is still there. Now, this is in Corinth, and he's dealing predominantly here with mixed marriages. It is not very unlikely, in fact, it's fairly likely, that there will be marriages in that church where before either of the spouses became a believer or a Christian, they might have been practitioners in a pagan mystery religion, or maybe no religion at all. Now, all of a sudden, one of them becomes a believer, joins the church, and the very legitimate question comes up, what do we do now? We are unequally yoked, to use that old language. We're unequal in all of this kind of thing. You got a believer and an unbeliever. Are we supposed to stay together or not? After all, Paul, you said in your earlier letter that what does Christ have to do with Belial? And what do we have to do with relating to unbelievers and being in those kinds of relationships? And so it's a very interesting tack or way that he goes here, but it is based in the reality of the day and the reality in that particular church. And he speaks, this is one of those places where Paul speaks expecting the same authority given to his words as if Jesus himself suddenly appeared and said, "This is what I say to you." You should still stay together. If the other partner, if the other spouse agrees to live in that marriage under those kinds of principles, shouldn't divorce. Because the ideal is still one-to-one forever. And then he says something kind of interesting. For the unbelieving husband is consecrated through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is consecrated through her husband. Now, some people have tried to take that so far as to say, well, if you're in that relationship, you continue to live in that relationship under those arrangements, and something happens to the unbelieving partner, that God will give them special grace because they were married to the believer. I'm not so sure that's what he's really saying here. I think what Paul is indicating is that the other spouse is at least brought within the influence, the sphere of influence that the believing spouse has. And it may very well be possible that that person will ultimately be influenced to become a believer by that spouse. It doesn't mean you're covered. It means that there's that possibility. You've got that influence from that believing spouse. And so, no, you shouldn't just jettison the marriage, but rather continue so that hopefully the unbelieving spouse will indeed, under that influence, come to be a believer. Now, I've heard folks in all the years that I've done marriage counseling and all, there have been a few out there that I've heard say, "Well, you know, I know he's not a Christian. I know he does this and I know he does that. But once we're married..." And I look at them and say, you know, as an old pastor said one time, words that I kind of remember for a long time, once you get married, you lose all your bargaining power. Before you get married, you can hold that over and say, "Well, you know, we won't get married unless you change this." But once you get married, you've lost all your bargaining power. And if you think you're going to change them, look at the statistics. The statistics go much more in the other direction than they do with the believer changing. And besides, don't think you're going to change them once you get married, because that's no way to enter the marriage. You already have a strike against you. We're going to go ahead and get married because I'm going to change him, or I'm going to change her. I mean, you can go all the way back in the Old Testament and find out God said, "Now don't intermarry with these other people in the land when you take the land over." Why? Because then you will play the harlot and go after their ways, in particular their religious ways. And they said, "Oh, no, that won't happen." And then they got in a whole lot of trouble. Because that's exactly what did happen. And so he says, you know, you're not going to change them necessarily. Don't go into the marriage with that kind of an idea. But if you are in that kind of situation and you are married, don't just jettison the marriage because you don't see everything alike. Anybody in here that has been married that you saw everything alike with your spouse? If you would please stand up.
Okay.
Very easily join you there.
I'm just getting down so I'm not standing up. That's like, I've told it before and you've probably heard it several times, but you'll hear it again. This doesn't have anything to do with marriage, but that situation is like the old preacher was, the old drunk that came walking in, passed out on the back pew and was snoring real loudly all through the service, the preacher got up and started preaching. He was still snoring loudly, and the preacher said, "I'm going to put a stop to this." And so very quietly he said, "Everybody's going to heaven, stand up." Everybody in the congregation stood up except this old drunk. He just kept snoring. Sit down. Everybody sat down. Very loudly he said, "All right, now everybody in here that's going to hell, stand up." My drunk jumped up and he looked around and stood there a second and he said, "Well, preacher, don't look like it's going to be much below just you and me." So, have to be careful about those things. So nobody stood up and I got down off my feet. We don't have that within us. We don't always agree. And Paul recognizes that, but he said that the fact that you don't always agree on everything is no reason not to remain married. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. That is, they are if something happens to them. And this is one of those things that the church debated for a long time, and in official church doctrine, as the church grew within the Roman Catholic Church, I mean, you had this idea of limbo, where children who didn't have an opportunity to make the profession of faith, you know, that, out there before that, there was this idea that, well, where do they go? What happens to them? Well, they're just in limbo. They don't go all that low and they don't go all that high. You know, they're just kind of dancing around with Chubby Checker. And then this is where pedo or infant baptism comes in. The idea of covering, although it's been misused by many folks and a lot of predominantly folks who have been baptized as infants and see it as baptism, it has been used to say, well, there's no need to do anything later. That's not what it's meant for. It's meant to, it's a dedication of the child by the parents and the church that they'll be raised in a Christian home and within the church. But it was also a way to kind of cover the child if something happened to them before they could make a profession of faith, that God, you know, the idea that God would not turn that child away and put him in limbo or hell or whatever because they never had an opportunity. Here, when he says, you know, as it is, they are holy, that's kind of, and this is an early idea. So it's not something that just developed later in the church. This is an early idea and a discussion that those children are considered, if something happens to them as young children and they haven't had an opportunity and they really don't understand and can't make that decision, that they would be considered by God as the children of a Christian and God would care for them. That they didn't have to worry about those children. So this is an early idea in the church. And it really has some of its roots within the whole idea of Judaism, where you become a man when you're 12 years old.
So what happens to children that need a parent?
What happens to children that neither parent was a Christian? That was an interesting discussion that still goes on among church people and non-church people even today. There are some who would... Calvin said that what happened to them was that if they died and they were among the elect, then God would accept them. But if they died and they were among pagan folks, then they were predestined among those who were not elected, and therefore they were going to go to hell and be punished because God had already decided, well, these are the ones that are going to be predestined for redemption, and these are the ones that are going to be predestined for punishment, and there's nothing you can do. That's where Calvin and some of his proponents and adherents would go with that. Luther and some others in the church said, well, yeah, there is a limited predestination. God predestined some for certain particular kinds of service, but everybody else has a choice, and that children would be covered if they are not raised within a Christian home and within a Christian church, and they die at a young age, God's not going to, you know, too young to know the difference, and they've never heard, God's not going to punish them. Not a loving, caring God. And yet you still have those kinds of discussions that go on today between, I mean, even Calvin taught, and some Calvinists today teach as well that membership in the church, just because you are in a Christian home and your parents go to a particular church and they're supposedly among the elect in that church, a Calvinistic church, that that doesn't necessarily mean that their children are. And if the children later come to the church and remain in the church and they're faithful in the church, then obviously they were among the children predestined to be there. But if they become the real wild child and run off and do all kinds of other things and they stay away from the church and they run away from the church and they die in that kind of state, well, see, the parents might have been predestined to be among the elect, but that child wasn't. Don't parents get upset that their child was, quote, predestined not to be? I would imagine they would. And it's really kind of interesting because I've had some discussions with some highly Calvinistic folks in years past, parents who insisted that their children were among the elect because they were in their family and their family did all this stuff at the church. I said, but what if they get to 20 years old, 30 years old, and they run away from a church and stay away from the church? Oh, no, no. They were still predestined to be among the elect, and God's not going to turn them away because of the... In the tulip, that's where... With some, the P in tulip, the tulip of Calvinism, five-point Calvinism, is perseverance of the saints, but for some, it's preservation of the saints. And that they may have been predetermined to go through that kind of stuff and to die in that kind of state because it might help somebody else come along. They were predestined for that, but God preserved them from that. So, which is, yeah.
That's what we're trying to teach you about God being a just God.
Is that contradictory about God being a just God? If you see just as talking about justice only, and not just as talking about treating justly and fairly. Of course, then again, nobody has ever said God had to be fair. The Bible doesn't say that. God has to be fair. God is God, and God can choose to do otherwise. But I think we see in what God, the grace and the mercy that God has shown folks, and in Jesus of Nazareth and in other situations, I think God's more than fair with us, but that's just my personal opinion. But yeah, I mean, for some that would seem to go against the idea of God and God's justice. If we see the concept of a just God simply dealing with the idea of justice and retribution, reward and punishment, reward because of what you do, punishment because of what you do, not necessarily because of who you are inside. Because we know people can be truly good inside and still have moments where they lapse and do something that's not so good. But yeah, it would seem to go against the idea of a just God if you're talking about justice, Jerry, and that kind of thing. So that was a question all the way back then, and it was actually a question back in Judaism as well. What happens? What happens if a child, something happens to a child before they reach age 12? At age 12, they're an adult. They're on their own.
What is the age of reason?
Well, actually, that was a period in history. No.
you know, children.
Different children, reason differently and at different levels at different ages. The whole idea of that idea of the age of reason being 12 is something that came along and was developed within some Middle Eastern cultures. And you know, a person took on those responsibilities at that age. You know, we in Protestant life in particular, and not just Baptist life, but Protestant life in particular, that's one of those kind of nebulous things that we just grab out of the air and then solidify it and codify it and say, well, you know, at this point. And yet there are folks who have a deeper understanding at age 8, 9, or 10 about spiritual things and their need at that point than some folks who are 45 and 55. So, you know, where is that age of reason? I don't know that we can really set a limit on it per se. I think you have to talk with the individual. This is one of those areas because of the whole idea of believer's baptism and there being something more to it than just saying, well, you know, my buddies did it, and so I believe in Jesus, and I'm going to go on down too. There has to be more understanding than that. That's why I'm very leery. Although, you know, I've known folks 8, 9, 10 years old who had, you know, who were baptized, who made that profession of faith, who were baptized. They didn't always live great lives after that. But you know, you start getting some of these, some places, and there are some Baptist churches that tout. I was reading, I can't remember the name of it right now, but I was reading an article recently where a news article where a Baptist church baptized like 25 or 30 children ages 4, 5, 6, and 7. And I'm saying, no, I don't think that's awfully close to the pedo baptism. And when you use gimmicks as well, I think there's a age of reason. The gimmicks, I mean, like the guy out in Arkansas a couple of years ago was talking about, had a lot of baptisms, a lot of children and youth baptisms in the church out there, Southern Baptist Church, and some of the designers from Disney had actually come and been consultants, and their children's and youth, big children's and youth center that they built, they designed it. So it's almost going to, like going to a mini Disney. But every time a child was baptized, made a profession of faith, and then was baptized, the baptismal pool in that building was in the shape of a fire engine. And the red lights came on the fire engine, and the siren blew on the fire engine. Everybody came and gathered around and cheered and clapped as this person goes up into the back of the fire engine, and that's where they're baptized. And they were baptized with a lot of young children. Who doesn't want to climb on it? Jump in the back of the fire truck in the heated water, you know, and everybody comes up and cheers and claps for you, and you got these red lights going and sirens and bells and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know that that's a question that we can ever truly answer. I think we have to be discerning in those areas and have to ask some key questions and listen to what is said. And then give an opportunity for children of any age to reflect on, okay, what does this really mean? And do I really understand what I'm doing?
Was that really, I mean, I don't really see that as being all that novel, because when Jesus was out, he told, you know, told everyone, you know, let the children come to me. And he was down with the children. And to me, that was basically giving that same message that, you know, the children don't understand necessarily what's going on, and I am going to take care of them.
Well, you do have Jesus, let's children come to me, and he's with children, and he warns people who mislead children. And all that kind of, and you should have the faith of a child. And what he means there is you should approach it when you make that initial. It gets more later, but there's more to it later. When you make that initial, it should be as uncluttered as possible, as with when a child is uncluttered in their faith for that parent or that special individual that works with them, etc. So, you know, no, it's not, but I think that unique and that novel. But I think this whole idea here that the children are holy is what Paul says here is, you know, the question is raised. Okay, you've got a believer and a non-believer, and they have children. What about the kids? What happens to the children? And that's a question that had been going on in Judaism and other areas as well. And he says here, if something happens to the children, God's going to take care of them. They're regarded as, and I put quotes around it, Christian children.
And in the early history of Israel, the men had multiple wives and all the concubines.
Yeah, men in early history of Israel, many of them had multiple wives and concubines.
Is that something that resolved itself through the ages? It's certainly different here than it was back in the church.
There were probably still polygamists around. It hadn't completely gone away. There's still people in the postmodern world who say that's the way it's supposed to be because that's what happened back in the Bible. That was a societal thing. That wasn't something that God said, okay, go out and do this. That was a societal thing. Even David had multiple wives. And when it says that David was a man after God's own heart, I don't think it was talking about his multiple wives. I think it was talking about other things and the way he connected with God and the way he cared for the people. I still think that the whole polygamous issue was a, kind of a blight on his record. And some people say, well, but with the death rates and the infant mortality and all that kind of stuff, and you needed to have a lot of people around, a lot of kids around to help you on work the land and all that kind of stuff. But once again, that's cultural and societal. That's not here within Judaism or Christianity. That's not a religious teaching, a religious doctrine. He moves further in here, and I know we're bumping up on time, but I do want to get here. He moves further. But if the unbelieving partner desires to separate, let it be so. In such a case, the brother or sister is not bound, for God has called us to peace. Wife, do you know whether or not you will save your husband? Husband, do you know whether you will save your wife? If the partner here, the one who is out doing whatever, I don't think, and people say, okay, well, what if you got two believers? Doesn't that negate this? I'm not sure that it does in every case. I think you have to look at the individual cases. I think that there can be two believers and still one or sometimes both end up pursuing things that are detrimental not just to the marriage but potentially detrimental to the physical well-being of the spouse. And that would be a similar situation to hear the unbeliever desires to separate. Let it be so. In such a case, the brother or sister is not bound. If that freedom is demanded, and what it means here to desires to separate, the idiom here in the text is one of an overwhelming, this is how it's going to be or else situation, then let it be so. For God has called us to peace. And I think that reflects in part not only Paul's situation and understanding that that unbeliever may be so desirous of leaving, and the believer does everything they can to hold it together, and it becomes dangerous. Not just spiritually, but it is emotionally and physically dangerous. There are times, although I think too we have to understand that it's only when every other possible avenue is exhausted. There may be times where divorce is the only option. For God has called us to peace. There are a lot of biblical scholars that have interpreted this particular section to be talking about when the marriage and the family life becomes a war zone. And the believing partner, or even in the case of two believers, one partner is trying their very best to keep things together, to work things out, to make a difference, but it becomes absolutely dangerous. God doesn't intend for you to stay in that kind of relationship. That is not peace for anyone. Not anyone in the family, unless we forget it's not just the spouses that are affected. It's the whole family. It's children. It's others. Paul is not giving an easy out here. Paul is talking about a situation where everything is tried to keep things together and to rectify the situation and to make it better. But there may be, it may get to the point where there is no peace and it's dangerous, and that might be grounds for separating / divorcing. And in that case, he says, the brother or sister is not bound. Now, many people will say, okay, I understand. It's all that they're not bound to that marriage, but they still can't remarry. I think there's the understanding implicit and some things in some other texts. And once again, I think you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. And when, this is my opinion. You can agree or disagree. That's okay. The brother or sister is not only not bound to that marriage, but there are instances where they're not bound against prohibitions to remarry another believer. I don't think you jump back into the same situation you had before. Unfortunately, there are people that are drawn to those things. But, and I think people can have those things happen, and the prohibition against remarrying, you know, let them remain separate or else they're committing adultery, I think that goes out the window. But once again, I think that's not the easy fix that a lot of people have made it. Quick story. I'll try to make it quick. True story. I've told it before in some venues. Can't remember if I told it to this kind of situation or not. Before we came to South Carolina, was in a church, Hokum Memorial Baptist Church in Burlington, North Carolina, Minister of Education and Activities. And there'd been kind of a rough go, and we'd had an interim for a while, and then there was a guy that came, Tom Gaskins, and preached a trial sermon. He told the search committee about his life situation, and they checked it out. And he told the church, and they listened. When Tom graduated from high school, Tom and his high school sweetheart married. He went into the military. I know I've told some of y'all this. Don't know if I've told everyone. He went into the military, and he became a medic, corpsman, and was gone a lot in training and then gone a lot for other things. After a while, his wife decided that she didn't like the idea of spending her time at home alone at night, so she started issuing invitations to other people to come and share her evening all night long. I know I've told it to some of y'all because now it comes back. But it fits here, I think. Tom found out. He started working to try and keep everything together, and they decided the problem was loneliness. And so they decided to try and fix that problem. And you probably know how they tried to fix that problem, and that's not the way you do it. And she gave birth to a son. And Tom was away when he was about 6 months old, was away on something with duty, and came home and found the baby asleep in the crib, the doors locked, and a note that she had run off with somebody else and she'd be coming back later to get the baby and her stuff. He fought that. She wouldn't come back. He pursued her for a long time, trying to get her to rectify. She wouldn't. By the way, she got the child. Sometime later, his parents sued, and they got custody of the child. And the interesting thing is, when he reached, I can't remember, it was 12 or 13, and the court said he could choose with whom to live, he chose to live with his dad. Tom worried over it, kept trying and trying. No. Eventually, he felt he needed to go to college and felt a call to ministry. So he went to Campbell, graduated from there, and went to seminary, where he met Martha Lou, who is his wife. They have, well, last I knew, they had two daughters. It's been a while since I've heard from them. But they went through a great deal of soul searching and wrangling and praying and talking with professors and marriage counselors and others. What do we do? Yeah. By the way, his wife filed for divorce from him. And you know, what do we do? We really love each other, we feel. And everyone with, well, most everyone, not everybody, but most everyone they talked with went to this passage and talked about grace and looked at this and said, "You're given the situation, given the circumstances, you're not bound not only to that marriage, you and Martha Lou, who, by the way, was in seminary working on a Master of Divinity as well. Y'all want to get married? There's, you know, you go through the counseling and all, there's nothing that keeps you from doing that." And he told the church, and the church voted 170-something to 3 to call him. Now, in the year and a half that we were there after that, before coming here, before that, there were probably 17 to 20 divorced or divorced and remarried folks in the church, range anywhere from their early 30s to early 50s, who would come sometimes, but none of them were regular. By the time we had left, all but one or two of them were there every time the doors were open. They were holding leadership positions in the church. They were teaching Sunday school classes. They were doing other things as well. No one will ever convince me that, at least in part, Tom's earlier life situation didn't have something to do with that. And he had a good ministry among those folks. So I think, you know, we have to be careful. Divorce is not the unpardonable sin, although many churches make it such. We will let somebody who's committed multiple murders and they go to prison and they have a Jesus moment, and then they do all this good behavior and they get out on parole, and we'll not only let them teach Sunday school class. I used to say, we'll not only let them teach Sunday school class, we'll put them out on the sawdust trail and let them collect Kentucky Fried Chicken buckets full of money. And we do all kinds of publicity and lift them up and look what a great change they've had. And it is. But then we'd turn around, the same folks would turn around, and somebody has a failed or a bad marriage. And they may have done everything they could to keep it from being that way. And a lot of churches won't even let them teach Sunday school class, much less be a deacon or do anything else. And once again, my opinion, my humble opinion, it's a travesty. There's only one unpardonable sin according to the Bible, and that's blasphemy of the Holy Spirit, whatever that turns out to be. But I think Paul is using here, he's saying, you don't know if you'll help your person get saved or not, but you shouldn't stay in that kind of relationship if it gets that bad. You're not required to stay there. And you're not bound to it just because you think, well, I'll change them. 10 years down the road, nothing but blood and guts. Well, I'll change them. If I hadn't changed them in 10 years. And it's that kind of situation. Probably not going to. I know none of this has anything to do with 2009. Paul's letters are not old, dead stuff. They don't always come across clearly, and they don't always come across easily. But he was very concerned about what was going on here, and how that was affecting not just the witness of the church outside, but how it was affecting the church on the inside. So once again, last week and this week, we deal with that little, one of those little three-letter words that can lead to a second three-letter word. That little three-letter word of and very powerful little three-letter word of sex, both within the church and within society, and what it might bring. And it's a very real question for us as well as for Paul. May you find grace as you go. May you find mercy. May you find guidance. And may you find the peace of relationships in Christ and in each other. God bless you and go in peace. Amen.